Why did Humza Yousaf decide to quit as FM? Did he quit for the right reasons? Did he have any choice? Who will now be the next leader of the SNP and First Minister? Is it a shoo-in for John Swinney? Will Kate Forbes stand? Should she stand? What about the Greens? Have they cut off their noses to spite their faces? What about ALBA? There's an awful lot of questions now in the mix in the wake of the huge events of today. So an early podcast with Pat, one subject, and it is Humza Yousaf's resignation.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this unexpected early edition of the Leslie Riddick podcast. And I don't know about anybody else, but I was working away in a wee world of my own, doing my own thing, oblivious to the world, while Leslie was desperately trying to get in touch with me to say, have you seen the news that Humza Yousaf has resigned? And all my notes and thoughts on everything that we were going to be doing tomorrow about all the permutations that could possibly take place, boom, out the window. And as Harold Macmillan once allegedly said, events, dear boy. Events. Yes. A surprise? Not a surprise, Leslie? Were you taken by surprise by all of this?
Totally by surprise. I mean, I was busy quietly semi-dying in bed with what you can hear. I've got, you know, it's a cold, or it could actually be a bit of a chest infection. On top of the old Lyme disease, I hear you cry. Exactly.
Yes, lucky you, yeah.
So I'd actually been off over the last few days on an extremely jolly time in the end in Arran and West Kilbride. Beautiful weather, fantastic crowds at the Denmark film. Lots of conversation, actually, about Humza Yousaf, and quite a few people who had not voted for him saying that they'd actually kind of come round to his style of things and quite liked his non-combative sort of stance. They liked his Gaza stuff. They thought he was a, you know, relentlessly cheerful character, which they kind of rated in the face of all the carnaptiousness around and so on. And then wallop, you know, suddenly this morning, that's it. When it looked as if, you know, he could have stitched, well, he could, there you are, stitched this together. It's just got all, even the phrase is redolent of the old guard, you know, slightly desperate ways of running politics. And I don't know, you know, Alex Salmond has been on off saying that actually Humza had spoken to him. I think it must be at 7:30 this morning, or maybe it was Sunday, trying to, you know, agree to the proposals that Ash Regan had put forward. I do love the way that Ash Regan has been kind of airbrushed out of this, and somehow it's Alex Salmond. You know, it's almost like no political commentators can believe that a woman could actually have more clout than the substantial form of Alex Salmond. And Alex pointing out that the things that Ash had actually asked for were sort of, you know, things that any independency government would probably, you know, they're not impossible to respond to. But his suggestion is that the old guard of the SNP, who just don't want any credibility conferred on ALBA at all, had basically vetoed it. And that left Humza with nowhere to go, because he had terminally hacked off the Greens, even though he will probably be the most pro-Green First Minister from the SNP that could possibly ever have been found. You know, them's the ironies. He just didn't have anywhere else to go and decided he wasn't going to prolong the agony. It looks like that could well have been it. And actually, Alex might actually also be right in another thing that I see in the front page of the National today, which is Alex saying that really the thing that brought the whole end of the Beaut House agreement to a head was Patrick Harvey's interview, two of them actually, where he was directly asked about the cast review on children presenting with gender confusion, and couldn't say that he backed that report, wouldn't, asked five times. And that actually was the tin lid for an awful lot of SNP people. And I think that's probably true, because I don't think it was the loss of the Green targets. I think the Greens had actually agreed that it was grown up to accept the reality, which was that they had been missed. So this might be why everything has kind of just kind of gathered pace over the weekend. But it's still, I've got to say, the phone just started going bonkers. And obviously I realised that this had happened. I don't know if you managed to see his statement, did you, Patrick, in the end, well, or not?
Yes, I've seen some of it. I mean, I thought it was impressive talking about preparing. Well, it wasn't impressive. Yes, I suppose it was repairing divisions across the political divide, and it can only be done with someone else in, at the helm. And he was not willing to trade in my values or principles to do deals merely for retaining power. And I thought that that maybe needed teasing apart slightly, because like you, I was absolutely convinced that the cast review response by the Greens was the breaking point. And the other aspect of it was that I was going to say was that I thought Yusuf, Hunter Yusuf, displayed determination, displayed leadership, and in a very different way to that he's done previously before as the great negotiator and the great bringer together of people, and actually making a decision to say, no, on this point, this has become politically in a political drawback for the SNP. And I've got to think about that as the SNP leader. And I disagree with Patrick Harvey on the statements he's made about the cast review. And then, to me, it just seemed to be a series of rollbacks on it, culminating on Sunday with Ian Blackford offering apologies to the Greens for the way it was done. And I thought at that point, alarm bells started to ring with me about what support Hamza Yusuf was actually retaining within his own political party from what might be referred to as the old guard.
Well, you know, with reference to the Greens business, I mean, I think that was really Pat's interviews were just not good on that. You know, it's no good. And it's actually no good as well from the point of view of Patrick Harvey to be actually a reasonably good communicator and fairly, you know, straightforward, actually, when it comes to so many issues. And suddenly on this one issue, the shutters go up. You're not speaking normally. You won't actually focus on what, you know, what the point of disagreement is. It becomes generalised. It was awful, quite apart from the fact of just not accepting what is clearly a huge, you know, pretty sizable body of work where, as we said in the previous podcast, Hilary Cass has already dealt with her end of that accusation and given numbers on how many different data sets were used and why some were rejected. Well, over to you now, I'm afraid, the opposition, nothing. So that was not good. And absolutely, that seems to have triggered the need to do something about it. On the other hand, what had also happened, obviously, was that the Greens had called for this emergency meeting of their own people to decide if they wanted to stay in the Bute House agreement. And of course, many people will say, quite rightly, that the SNP didn't want to end up being the kind of, you know, being the dog that was having its tail wagged, as it were, by the small party, and decided if there's going to be dumping, it would do the dumping first. The only thing was, by that stage, Patrick Harvey had actually said, staked his leadership on his on getting support from his party, winning them round to staying in the Bute House agreement. So I think that may have also fueled the Greens' reaction in the wake of that morning sort of, you know, cheerio, because essentially he had put, you know, he'd staked his I don't know where he goes from now. Maybe nowhere, you know, maybe that's fine. But I mean, this is not a great piece of, if everybody's saying, well, this was not a great piece of tactical work by Hamza Yusuf, well, blow me. I don't think it covers the Greens in glory either. But nonetheless, that I think explains the huge outburst of anger that happened immediately afterwards, where things were said by Lorna Slater and Patrick Harvey. And this is like, I've just written a thing for The National for tomorrow about this. It's a tremendous skill to keep a calm sooth. You know, you'll live to regret being spiteful and saying things about people that will never be undone. And, you know, I think that's a problem here, because the Greens came out and talked about, Hamza personally betraying a generation, and, you know, other really strong words that once said could not be unsaid. And then actually couldn't let you get to a situation where you could look like you had a vote of confidence in the guy, because you just trashed him in public. So they quickly had a very emotional reaction. Even by the end of the same day, everyone had calmed down a bit, but it was too late by then. So this is a very unfortunate state of affairs. And when you come back to what you were saying about Ian Blackford apologising for, you know, riling the Greens, the only thing is, it's not kind of kowtowing or sort of saying, oh, you know, it's just saying that actually, if you were going to get to a stage where you wanted to move off your right foot a little and put more weight on your left, you could have done it without falling over. You know, if you wanted to not have an arrangement with the Greens, but just move into a less formal kind of just loose, kind of, I'm sure there's a proper phrase for it, you know, supply and whatever it is. If he wanted to do that, there might have been a more subtle way of doing it, or there might not have, you know, who knows? So that's all it is because now here we are. So that's not an ideal situation. And I think, I don't know, you know, I sense there's quite a lot of sympathy for Hamza around actually beginning to develop. The more people take pot shots, especially people like Douglas Ross and, you know.
Yes.
I mean, wait till we get to, if they actually go ahead with their blooming votes of no confidence in on Wednesday and Thursday, you know, or you get Douglas Ross and Anas Sarwar. This is where, this is what I was kind of writing about. It matters how you go and it matters how you frame the thing up. And I think Hamza Yousaf, whilst there's some people, insiders, who can see coding in some of the things he said, he was generous enough to take it on the chin and say, I did this, it was my mistake. He talked in very upbeat ways about lots of aspects of life, the changes that he's seen about ethnic diversity at the heads of all the governments around Britain. He also said quite modestly that he would be pursuing that from the back benches and continuing to support Gaza. He talked about trying to, you know, equalise income as a big income redistribution as a big objective of his. Still good that he just placed that in the mix whilst all the public's attention is on him. And when he talked about the pride he felt as First Minister of this country, nobody could doubt that he just radiated pride in that. Not pride in that sort of horrible pride comes for a fall way, but you just look at this guy and think, yeah, this really meant a lot to him. So I think he's handed the ball over. You know, there was no acrimony in the end of it. He said, I don't hold ill will towards anyone. It started to remind me of all these blooming last things people said on the blooming scaffold before they had their heads chopped off, you know, back in the day.
Yes.
But it does matter. You know, nothing became him better than his going. That was an important thing to do because now the comments of other people are slightly held against the framing that he's created, which is, OK, I screwed up. There's lots of good things in there. The thing he said about independence, like a marathon and the last few miles are the hardest. Well put. You know, there's no point in being falsely optimistic. We're not in a great situation. That's true. But we're not nowhere. And that was, you know, just a small, well put phrase. So that ends his time pretty strongly. Now it's up to everybody else to watch how they speak, because this is, this parliament is a proportional parliament. And the idea that you can throw your weight around and allow yourself the luxury of sounding off and, you know, being antagonistic and slagging off anybody in this parliament, no matter how strongly you feel about stuff, you can hardly do it because you'll end up back at the electoral arithmetic.
Yes.
You know, it hasn't changed one iota since yesterday or the day before. There's still, it's a very, very thin line between, you know, this government being able to operate and not.
Yes, because one of the things that I was thinking about was the fact that even if there was a deal reached of some kind of sort, or Hamza Yousaf and the SNP actually said to Ash Regan, go on, vote against us. Yeah, vote against me on a vote of no confidence, vote against the Scottish government on a vote of no confidence. And just like the Greens, and I think there would have been an absolute electoral disaster for the Green Party, and it would have been a triumph for Alibi if the Greens had gone ahead with their vote of no confidence and voted with the Tories, Labour and the Lib Dems to bring down a pro-independence government, particularly given the statements that Lorna Slater has made about saying that independence was not a red line and they'd be quite prepared to work with other people. And as Martin Geisler said to her, would that mean working with Labour? Yes, yes, we would work with Labour. We would reach an arrangement with Labour. And again, setting alarm bells ring with those who did SNP 1 and voted Green 2 on the additional member system for the regional lists in order to secure in specific areas pro-independence majority of MSPs. So, and I think that the Alabama must have been, I would have said, must have been rubbing their hands together, thinking we've got a great opportunity here. And I just wonder if they did overplay their hand on that. But the key aspect of it, as you said, Leslie, is the fact that this was not ending there. This, the vote of no confidence may have been won by reaching deals or otherwise, or challenging people to bring down a pro-independence government. But there's the process of government that had to take place within that. All the other bills that had to be got through, all the other parliamentary work that had to be got through. And it just the other thing as well, it just calls into question, you know, was there any great necessity to initiate the Bute House agreement as Nicola Sturgeon did, or could the SNP have operated on a minority basis and, as you said, operate a confidence and supply arrangement if they want to make it slightly more formal, but then just try and say, as they did in the past, we could present a budget, let's have your input on this, and we can work in that less formal way. And that was a hostage to fortune, I think, engaging in a formal agreement. And it became incredibly acrimonious about that fault line that does exist within the Scottish National Party and about gender recognition and these gender rights and the rights of women and the rights of girls, as Ash Reagan referred to as well, which are all fraught and within the big tent of the SNP are particularly fraught and are definitely fault lines.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Although, I mean, we'll never know unless, those who have been insiders in that process, Nicola Sturgeon didn't look like a woman who had her hand up her back being forced into a lot of the policy initiatives that she took. I remember a strange, tearful video she put out at one point when she felt there were a lot of trans people leaving the party. And I thought that was a bit of a moment for a lot of feminists who thought, well, you know, there's a lot of women that have left the party and there was no late night tearful message to them. So, you know, in all of this, you're stuck with the Greens definitely, you know, embody and are happy to talk about an outlook towards gender rights, which will then, you know, puts them in your frame of thinking if there's legislation and policy coming forward that leads into really sticky areas. But actually, on an awful lot of the stuff that's being raised is contentious. I mean, we know a Tory voted for the Gender Recognition Reform Act. Mm-hmm. You know, Labour voted for it. You know, on a lot of the other stuff that really angered people, the bottle deposit thingy return scheme, we've said this before, was actually, you know, brought in, I can't remember, 2019 or something, but they were all predating the Bute House agreement. So the Greens have taken kind of quite a lot of, they've been out the front taking a lot of flack for what looks to people to be unpopular policies. I still think there's just a huge amount of work got to be done about explaining where you're coming from and actually getting off the top-down administration of these things. I mean, when I was on Aran, the first no-take zone in the UK is at Lamlash Bay there, which was organised locally by divers and local fishermen from the 1980s onwards. It took them 10 years to get the bureaucracy in place to get some official recognition for it. And they've now got, you know, it's a fantastic area they've got. We've now got four universities doing all sorts of studies because they've got the best before and after evidence in the sea of what you can do when you have some areas where there just is no take. They've got some of the best in the UK for that. So that was arranged locally. It wasn't done by somebody in Edinburgh telling you where you were going to have a no-take zone and saying, oh, by the way, there's also no compensation for all the fishing you lose. I mean, that was never going to work, whoever was heading that up. But the Greens of all people should have smelt a rat because they were meant to be the people who were about local politics, you know, small is beautiful. This is all, that's my disappointment, is that all of that stuff seems to have been lost. But still, we are who we are, and there's all the runners and riders chat starting. I noticed with some amusement that on the National, which has got very good coverage today, I mean, you don't need to go very far to get pretty much all the angles today in the National newspaper, which just, by the way, has got a special deal of £20 for a year's subscription at the moment, which I think doesn't run for very much longer, folks. Anyway, on their own poll, Kate Forbes is out, 35% of votes. Jenny Gilruth is next with 30%. Then John Swinney with 22%. And then Neil Gray and Mary McCallan far behind them. They've also done some soundings from William Hill, the bookies, which puts Neil Gray first. So I suspect that the voters, you know, that the national readers are a bit more finger on the pulse about this, because it does look like, you know, there's a strong push, I think, now to get John Swinney to be the safe pair of hands. And it may be that Kate has just decided this is not a good, even if she wanted to stand, this is not a good time to be doing it. Too fractious. she won't be able to get the Greens behind her pretty much at all, perhaps. And this just, generally speaking, might not be the best handover moment. On the other hand, quite a few of her lieutenants are out there arguing in her behalf, like Fergus Ewing, who was on this lunchtime, sort of saying, only she would do. Yeah, and I was listening to Fergus. Obviously, you heard him as well. And I mean, that's fine. It's a free world. Fergus has always been a big supporter of Kate Forbes. But my goodness, you know, he's sort of drifted into speaking about the Greens. And the bile is just unbelievable, you know. I mean, he was talking about them being fanatics, not proper politicians. You know, maybe you feel all these things privately, but you know, a moment like this, no, because especially also if you are a lieutenant of Kate Forbes, she needs you speaking like that, like a blooming hole in the head.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
Sorry.
Yeah, because I noticed that Patrick Harvey said the Greens can work constructively with a First Minister who shares our progressive values. And I think that Kate Forbes is a non-starter and within that framework for the Greens to work constructively with them.
She probably is a non-starter, but that doesn't mean to say that you once again need to rile everyone so much.
Exactly.
You start off with, you know, he was talking about them being extremist fanatics, that the SNP was fed up being a doormat, that, you know, this association with the Greens was like a late troubled adolescence and we'd finally grown up. I mean, you know, it's like, of course, you're entitled to feel all those things. But what you're doing is saddling your candidate with all your comments and bile so that there's no way the Greens could even, you know, they're never going to come out and sort of, you know, say, yeah, this is great. We could be, but, you know, maybe over time there could be something and Kate could put a deputy in who's a little bit more emollient and that could pull people together. But this is the real world. This is how you have to inch your way forward when you haven't got a blinking majority, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the way people are talking here, I think people have spent too long in their heads down south where you can do this grandstanding, you get elected on a minority of the vote with an 80-seat majority, you can say blacks, white, Rwanda's safe forever, you can do what you want, you can tear up agreements, you can jeopardise human safety, nobody can get you, you can, you know, prorogue parliament and it takes a whole bunch of Scottish MPs led by Joanna Cherry to just be able to check you. That's, you know, Westminster thinking, and it arises from getting majorities where nobody can touch you. But this is different, you know, and I know a lot of people listening and even looking from these votes with Kate out in front, people will feel they just don't care if she's got the hackles up, a few Greens, they're yesterday's people, who cares? And indeed, Kate would be a strong candidate if she chooses to do it. But clearly, I think they're beginning to move behind John Swinney.
Yes, because Kate herself has said she's made no decision. And I was interested to read, because you mentioned Joanna Cherry before, she said that she specifically referred to needing the Stephen Flynn healing approach, and she was very complimentary about the way he brought the feuding factions together at Westminster. And she said he particularly appreciated his approach to the Prime Minister's questions and media appearances. And just speaking on a very personal basis, I think the smart move would be for the SNP to actually drop its stance on MPs and becoming MSPs, etc., even though Stephen Flynn has now come out to support John Swinney as the candidate. He's now said that he supports John Swinney, along with, I think, Jenny Gilruth, Keith Brown. You know, so it is that whole thing going. But what Joanna also said was that there was a necessity to step away from the continuity candidate. You know, the continuity. And safe pair of hands, is he continuity? Because John Swinney, I mean, people listening to this podcast may very well not have forgotten the fact that John was leader of the SNP at one point. And He was criticised for his centralising approach. I remember, I think it was Bill Wilson who stood against him for the leadership of the SNP, and it eventually came down to a very fractious situation where Alex Salmond went to John Swinney, I believe, and said, look, you better stand down before senior members of your cabinet, senior SNP people will actually demand your resignation. So, good pair of hands, Deputy First Minister. If my preference were there, if he were up for it and the regulations allowed, I actually think that Stephen Flynn would be someone, given his track record at Westminster and his ability, obvious abilities in communication, and his policy stances as well, I think would be the person for it. But he is not going to go for it, and I think by his throwing his weight behind John Swinney, I think that may be very well the nomination that succeeds. But of course, it will come down to the membership of the Scottish National Party, as we noted from last time, which is you've got to get, I think, is 100 nominations from 20 local branches, and then it goes through this additional member, style of vote that Hamza Yousaf narrowly won on last time against Kate Forbes.
Yeah. But I think it looks like they've decided pretty much that Stephen also has obviously decided this is not the time to, well, he's in the wrong place to make the move. He could be the leader of the SNP, but not the First Minister in Westminster. I mean, people might remember back to when Alex Salmond was leader of the SNP and in Westminster as an MP, but the SNP were not in government in Holyrood at the time. So you can't, you know, he has to shift and get back up the road. He's not going to be able to do that unless, you know, somebody's persuaded to stand down and create a by-election, which I don't expect anybody is going to want to do. So that's not going to happen kind of imminently. And there may be just be a feeling amongst those two obvious contenders, Kate Forbes and Stephen Flynn, that they just want to see this boat steadied a bit more before they kind of make the delicate move from one, you know, foot to the other.
Yeah, because I mean, I actually just reflect. I mean, I know I go on about football all the time, but no one wants to be the manager after Sir Alex Ferguson, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. You don't want to be the one after. You might think about being the one after, the one after, the one after.
Yeah.
You know, and you'll get a chance.
I'm sure a lot of people would raise their eyebrows at the kind of parallel of Hamza Yousaf and Sir Alex hair drying. Ferguson,
yes.
You know,
yes.
They're very different personalities.
Yeah.
But
well, I was thinking of the previous incumbents, you know, because of the, I mean, what no matter one thinks about the way it's finished up with Nicola Sturgeon, she was a star turn.
Mm-hmm.
She was a star turn.
I remember being in the Scotsman when Andrew Jaspin came in, in the 1990s, to just completely revamp the Scotsman, actually. And he went through the place like a dose of salt. So, I mean, he was the one that brought me over, from broadcasting and from Glasgow. I mean, two faux, you know, huge faux pas in the views of classic newsmen, literally so, that staffed the Scotsman at the time. And he kind of knew he wasn't going to be long for this world, because basically when you go in and change a whole lot of stuff, people hate you. So it was kind of almost inevitable that he wouldn't, you know, stay long, and that the next guy, they would wait to let him do all the sort of horrible stuff that had to be done, so that the next editor that came in just didn't have all those, you know, redeployments and sackings, and the stuff that was all unpopular was done by a guy who left. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying Hamza's done any of that, actually. As I understand it, some of the behind the scenes, there have been a little bit of a better manoeuvring put into the systems that surround the general election. I don't really know too much about that, whether it's IT systems or just, you know, staffing and canvassing and returns and so on. I know from speaking to people on the ground, they're still annoyed at how slow the party is to vet candidates, though.
Yes, because, I mean, that's the whole thing. It tends to be forgotten. Oh, yeah. It tends to be forgotten when it's been particularly when being covered by the the metropolitan media, because I've been absolutely stunned. I mean, I don't know if you noticed the fact that on the BBC's website, they had the question, who is Hamza Yousaf? You know, and Laura Koonsberg on Sunday was having to explain the fact of the proportional representation system in Scotland and the way the Scottish Parliament was organised and this and that and the other. I'm thinking, you know, it's, we just forget about the fact that the lack of knowledge, and that came through. And I was quite surprised because the news agency does seem to be the go-to place for people to make statements, as Mary Black did. But that's apparently where Stephen Flynn is making a statement about his support for John Swinney and the fact he's not standing. But the general election, I mean, and I think the aspect of this is as well that that must have been uppermost, I think, in Humza Yousaf's mind, that if something had to happen, which he was going to have to go before he was pushed, because this would undermine completely the SNP at the forthcoming general election, where there'll be an incredible number of tight seats. And despite what Douglas Ross says, claiming that a by-election council victory in Arbroath seemed to signal the revival of the Conservatives across Scotland, it will be in many cases the fact of a fight between Labour claiming change and the SNP, who will be targeted as the continuity in the same, the continuity of government in the same way as the Conservatives are being targeted down south. So yeah, the general election, I think, is vitally important.
Yes, but I mean, although people had quibbles about Humza basically saying, you know, vote SNP to get rid of the Tories, in that clearly Labour are the bigger challenge for most of the country. Nonetheless, in Tory seats, the SNP are very often the second candidate. No, they are the challengers. So it would be the SNP who would unseat Douglas Ross, for example, not Labour. And so in the northeast of Scotland particularly, and I know, again, having been there recently doing the film, you know, Staying With People, you know, they had been kind of quietly optimistic, actually, about this long, slow work they'd done with candidates there. So that's where they will be trying to absolutely not have an upset just coming up to the last bit of, you know, and who knows when an election, what this has all shown you, is how quickly everything can kind of flare up. But still, coming back to your John Swinney bit, it's totally true. There are a number of different fault lines on the go. There's the bit of the gender issues are obviously the biggest thing that's going on. But behind that, there is still this question about being economically conservative or progressive, whichever way you want to put it. There's a lot of criticism about not having enough business voices in this cabinet, and Kate not having, I mean, she could still come in, you know, and John Swinney could have a different type of cabinet with very possibly Kate Forbes brought back into finance. I mean, we'll not see the whole sweep of what this government will feel like until we see how the cabinet's laid out.
Yes, and once the cabinet's laid out, I mean, that again will actually predicate, I think, on what way the Greens will jump in order to secure that majority. But as I said, the Greens, I mean, to talk about them for just a moment, they are actually walking electoral tightrope, I believe. I mean, just on it, I genuinely believe in it. I looked at the numbers. I mean, there was an almost direct correlation between the amount of second choice votes in the Holyrood elections, the regional list votes that dropped for the SNP, and the number of regional list votes that the Greens received. Because the Greens will always, because as they ought to, in a proportional representation system, get the number of people who actually vote for them. But in that particular sense, it is that way that they do achieve the number of MSPs that they've got. And I don't think, as I say, it's done them any favours, this whole thing. And they may be, I think a lot of people may be put off and may vote SNP 1-2, particularly in certain areas they do there. But again, to return to it, I do find it...
Well, then it's worth looking as well at then the ALBA business.
Yes.
Because, I mean, in a way, I thought Ash had put a fairly clever sort of little package together there on, obviously, there was going to be the emphasis on gender rights, competent government. Well, you know, how do you describe that? But the business of having a campaign to save Grangemouth, Kenny McCaskill has been putting a lot of time into that and has kind of made the point that Scotland would be the only oil producing nation, I think, in the world, but certainly in Europe, that does not have a way to refine its own product. And I mean, clearly most people are going, yeah, let's just get off oil hyper fast. But it's like anything, you know, there still will be oil used. It just means that we won't have the stability of a refinery here. So that's quite a kind of test in a way, because I think a lot of people around Grangemouth have been very hurt that nobody has been coming in from. They don't feel the government's been coming in sort of charging to the rescue.
Yeah, I mean, and we do have to recall the fact again, we spoke about it on previous podcasts. I mean, the setting up of green ports, you know, I mean, which are fundamentally free ports. I mean, and the negative impact that they can have on the surrounding area, and also the potential is for people to break through employment legislation, etc. And they're not exactly positive.
Yeah, but the other one was having her referendum bill. I mean, apparently, I don't know, but because I actually haven't been to Holyrood for some time, but Ash is kind of sitting, people don't really speak to her very much. And, you know, she's sitting up kind of on her own with that referendum bill, which is basically saying we should have a referendum to find out if the Scottish people want to have a referendum about independence, which, you know, it might still get struck down as being ultra-virus. But I mean, my God, if you get to this stage, what actually can we do? You know, you can't even have a blooming vote on whether to paint their own pipes green. You know, it's just like what? So, you know, there'll be some people who say there's no point in this. There'll be other people within, you know, the independence movement who think, well, what else are we doing? And kind of this at least would ruck the ground up a bit and kind of show, you know, you've still got the problem of if you had a low turnout, it just wouldn't matter. And it's very probable that if something feels that it hasn't got power within it, people won't turn out. And maybe that's the judgment the SNP have come to, that it could be tasty to have a bit of, you know, if you've got 80% of people turning out saying, yeah, we want an independence referendum, yeah, bams, let us decide when we want to go or not go, that would be good. but if you've got a kind of turnout of 34%, I don't know, but those are, and that, I don't know if these ended up being sticking points, because that was her kind of offer. And it could have been that the older guards, in that they've had longer time to think about that proposal because it's been around for a while, have just sort of thought, not this one, just we can't manage to get the excitement for it. If you can't, you also have got a problem, however, about the whole SNP strategy about kind of driving excitement up towards, you know, independence. And to be honest, we have, this is a big moment of difficulty, because having listened to lots of commentary, you know, the Lib Dems, the Tories, Labour, are all, I mean, you've just got to bite the carpet when you're sitting listening to them going on about, you know, that the SNP have done nothing except bang on about independence. And you know, you must be meeting a different SNP than me, mate, because most of us are worried the other way, you know, that we're not hearing enough. But it's an easy thing to say. And it's kind of, you know, it's picked up by British, you know, London-based presenters who have near Scooby, basically, what's going on. And they can trot a few things out which are true about the appalling rate of drug deaths. You know, they'll have another couple of statistics taken. I could put another couple of different ones. We've got the best performing A&Es across the whole of the UK. We've got the only thing that shifted child poverty in 40 years, according to Professor Danny Dorling, the Scottish Child Payment. We can all put our things in, you know, but then nobody is. You get two or three of them, one after the other, and you just get this terribly funereal feeling about the whole government, which is doubtless what they'll keep trying to do over the next couple of days. But I'd imagine that if you are in the SNP or an independent supporter, that will start to get you annoyed, because it gets me listening to it as I've been teed up waiting to go on things and listening to this stuff. By the time I'm on, thanks, mate, I've been revved up. You know, this has just annoyed the hell out of me listening to this stuff. So who knows how this could play out?
Yes, because I was fulminating on Sunday when I was watching all the programmes, that the way that every single presenter and interviewer allowed unionist MPs, unionist politicians to get away with making these broad brush statements about the incompetence of the Scottish government. And then to add insult to injury, we had after the politicians had made their statement, chief political correspondent on Sky came on, and when asked to analyse it, quite simply repeated what the person had said. I'm thinking there's nobody asking the actual questions, as Martin Geisler did brilliantly with Sir Keir Starmer, saying about, well, what is the democratic route to exiting this voluntary union? Which, Starmer came up, answered, came there, none. And it is that whole lack of it down there, the lack of questioning, the lack of understanding, the lack of care. And I mean, and I do have a significant difficulty. I mean, anytime I see Wes Streeting on, this is a very personal thing. I remember these very pink-cheeked younger priests when I was a young lad in my teens, who just never had to shave in their lives, coming on and talking piously about pious nonsense. And that's what Wes Streeting comes in. He looks like that anyway. But he put his boot in, you know? He put his boot in. Well, yeah, you'll not be able to unsee that now, will you?
A pink cheek. No, you should absolutely take it away.
But a pink cheek curate. But I mean, it is that whole thing of the ability to just to trot this out and the utter incomprehension of this, of what it was like up. But then
that's why I'm, despite coughing, everybody, when you get this podcast, please, a little round of applause for Pat, because I have had to actually put the mute button on and cough like a donkey, I don't know, 6 times already in this podcast, and Pat will have dutifully cut them all out. So, you know, I'm not at all in top form, but, what keeps me doing whatever, you know, requests come in. Like, for example, I was on Sky News for 6 or 7 minutes, it was just long for these interviews, about lunchtime today. Because eventually they will get to the point that they'll say, well, because they say, how do you want to be described? And I'll say, journalist and independence supporter. So that guides them towards the inevitable question. Well, you know, the woman said, look, you were actually on in the wake of Hamza winning this however long ago, and you were kind of optimistic about, you know, how things would work out. Do you feel closer or further from independence today? And I said, well, okay, a bit further. But I mean, I'm not, if everybody thinks again that this is the little phase that we're all going to retreat from, you're just so completely wrong. And you know, just one thing, we're sitting with the record fuel poverty in Scotland in a completely fuel-rich country with energy policy run by Westminster. That's just it on its own. That's enough for me. I'll be working for independence all my life.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I'm never worried at what might seem that hostile question, because it gives you the chance to say back what you want to say. The difficulty is when it's just kind of avoided, almost as if people don't actually almost have the courage to sort of say to you, well, your independence has gone a bit peak tong now, hasn't it, mate? Because, you know, we've all got something to say on that. So actually, I quite welcome it when they do push right through to where are you with independence? I mean, they may well say, what's your strategy now? And I'll say, I haven't, you know, not a Scooby.
Yeah.
Right. But this is what, you know, UK PLC is doing to Scotland, is that nobody can think of a straightforward way to be able to progress on something we've actually had an election about. So, you know, that, and that's the truth. So we have to keep coming back to, it's the same way as for the next Scottish government, they still have to face the actual statistics of how the votes went at the last election. You can't get away from the electoral arithmetic in that chamber. But equally, Britain can't get away from the fact that 50% of people still want a way out of the UK. And actually, I think quite a few broadcasters, that is still sitting. And in a funny kind of way, the greater the problems that are happening to the SNP, the more astonishing is that 50% support for independence. So that whilst in the past people used to go, 50% all you can get after Brexit and this and that and the rest of it, it's kind of looking the other way a wee bit now, which is, my goodness, you know, the received wisdom is that everything political is the genesis of a party and a leader. So, you know, everybody's still going on, oh, you know, the strength of Nicola Sturgeon and so on, fine. But this is just detached from all of those tropes. It's something on its own that doesn't depend completely upon what people think conventional politics is driven by. And that's the beautiful thing about it. I mean, I could be saying this and next week suddenly everyone could go, God, I've had enough. And, you know, definitely going around the country, people are kind of, everybody is really tired. And I think that marathon example pretty much does say it for people. The only thing is, I don't know how many blooming marathons we're going to have to go on. I mean, going on one would be enough for me, but at the time you finish, you feel you're going to have to start again. But nonetheless, here we are. This is how things are. And we need to have the chance to explain the whole context of it before we start scything each other to pieces for the tactical errors that, you know, that are going to keep us going around in circles. But for the time being, there's definitely got to be something that kind of stabilizes the Scottish government. And if it's going to be John Swinney, I've got to say John is is what they always regarded as this very safe pair of hands. I used to do Radio Scotland phone-ins when John was leader. And I can remember John coming into the studio in Glasgow, which really dates it. And we'd had an hour's phone-in. So, you know, punters were phoning in with questions for him. And at the end of the hour, we looked up through the glass and the news team had come through, which they generally did if, you know, something that had happened had suddenly made news. And so John had also glanced up and seen this through the glass and said, "Oh, my God, I didn't say anything, did I?" And I said, "Don't worry, John, you didn't say a thing," you know, which is John's skill, if you like, to look at it that way. I mean, he is not the most fireworky politician. People might feel at a time like this, that's fine, you know, the old safe pair of hands. And a lot of people actually behind the scenes, I've got to say, have just said that an awful lot of things that work within the way that the new welfare departments of the Scottish Government, that was set up in his time. And there's quite a lot of nuts and boltsy things around the back that apparently were his doing. I wish I knew more about that. I'm sure in the days to come, if he does become the leader, there'll be a bit more scrutiny on, you know, the backstory, as it were. But that looks like where we're going, because it doesn't look like Kate or I was going to say Errol Flynn won the job.
Errol Flynn, Stephen. I'm sure he'd be delighted. He won't be in like Flynn, as the old saying used to go. And I don't know if anybody else will stand. But it'll be intriguing to see if anyone else has put their... I'm going to use... Oh, my God, Joyce, put their head above the parapet at this point in time. And again, it will go to the Scottish Parliament to actually be voted on again. These are the arcane things that I recall from last time, the here we are again, is that I reckon that you will never get a unity unionist politician. You will not get Tories voting for Labour, Labour voting for Tories. Lib Dems might vote for a Labour candidate, whoever.
But I don't think it'll go that far, because on one of the things I was reading, apparently the Greens have said they will now abstain on both votes.
Yes, so
but that's enough to not make either of them succeed.
Yes, of course, but that's right on these. But the first minute, the new leader of the SNP will have to be elected as first minister, and that's the
I get your point.
So that at that point, I think that there will eventually, it does come down to a simple majority. If you've got to get more votes than the person who's the other candidate, and that's what will come down to. And there will be, that's true actually,
because. Do you not remember every time there's been any election, Willie Rennie has stood?
That's right.
When he was the Lib Dem leader. And you just think, God love you, mate. I mean, you got three votes, four votes. Yeah. Or something.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking back on Willie Rennie as the leader of the Liberal Democrats with fondness compared to Alex Cole Hamilton.
Yeah.
So Ross will stand, I would think. Sarah will stand. Will Alec Cole Hamilton, so full of himself, I'm sure he will. And inevitably, when everybody drops out, we'll come down to two candidates, and the more votes will go to whoever is the SNP leader than anyone else. And that's the reality of when the two things begin, that SNP leader has to help galvanise the political wing of the independence movement, and then put together a cabinet which can garner support across the House. I mean, depending on who, and it has happened in the past across the House. So we'll see what happens there. And I thought that just one thing, I would turn around and say that Ros Foyer of the STUC was particularly glowing in her comments upon Humza Yousaf, saying he was a friend of the trade union movement. He and his government had introduced progressive taxation measures and tackled child poverty, praised his stance on Gaza. And that has been across the political spectrum, since say people like Owen Jones, who would be natural Labour supporters, who have praised the stance on Gaza. She said, of course, that she would wish that the wealth and income distribution could have gone further. But that just shows, again, we spoke about it before, that the talents that Humza Yousaf has in terms of negotiation and working together may not be, in terms of the rough and tumble, the best when it comes to the rough and tumble of party politics,
but I mean,
even though I would hope it would be.
Yes, and that's collaboration too. You know, everything about building a if you like, a coalition for independence is slowly being able to win over groups just to speak to you who used to be indomitable opponents. You know, the trade unions, most of them organised from south of the border. The STUC took that brave stance under Ross Fowler that they would back the right to have a referendum. They still didn't come down on which way they would vote. But that was, you know, that was a major change in stance from the STUC. So it's important to keep all these groups on board. I mean, I don't think Hamza Yousaf's stuff about income redistribution is done just to keep, you know, the STUC on board. It's a genuine thing. You know, these are genuine policies. It's the only way you do actually manage to you know, forge long lasting kind of coalitions of support. But all of this does really matter. It's not small, this. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what other comments there are from, you know, wider civic society, if you like. And of course, Hamza's not disappearing yet. We're all speaking like that's the last thing he ever said. But obviously, since he's waiting until there's a new person in place, unless absolutely John Swinney is, you know, there's no opponent for him. And then I don't know quite what the procedure is about how quickly they can just, you know, open nominations, close them, and that's it. You've got it. And then, you know, a vote by the parliament and you're in. I guess it could be pretty quick. But he'll still have to do First Minister's questions and, you know, he'll still be pretty visible, which I guess will be kind of weird for him. But anyway.
Well, hats off to him for doing that. Hats off to him for standing there, because he knows what's coming his way. He absolutely knows what's coming his way. And I'll be intrigued. I think gloves may be off with Hamza Yousaf. I think you may actually see the person we saw in the stump, because what the heck? As I used to say to somebody, I mean, I eventually became the person I became in terms of my interactions with others who got on my nerves, realising they couldn't take me out the back of the bike sheds and put the head on me after 4 o'clock at school. So, you know, that's the analogy. Well,
there's that. But there's nothing more unsightly than someone trying to kind of do their thing with reasonable dignity and having utter childish pelters thrown at them by useless BAMs, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if especially Anas Sarwar has to watch. Nobody cares what Douglas Ross, no one has any expectations of him. His base is appealed to by you know, the notion that the Tories are the only people who can keep independence at bay. So he has to keep the big monster idea alive, and it doesn't matter if his behaviour is kind of, you know, hopeless. But Anas Sarwar, he's got to pull SNP voters over. So they may well be people who really quite quietly rate Hamza Yousaf or voted for him or voted for the SNP or whatever. So he's got to watch his tack, because that if he comes out in that sort of hysterical, contemptuous, trying to kick a guy when he's down type stuff, I mean, most Scots really kind of hate that stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's all there. And I think their motions of no confidence, which I imagine Hamza also has to be part of, will be happening on Wednesday of this week or Thursday.
Yeah.
So there'll be plenty, you know, shuffling around. And I just hope the whole SNP can keep that sort of dignity, is perhaps putting it too strongly, but just optimistic kind of outlook, and the no hard feelings, and the kind of we have to just keep through this, keep their peckers up and not resort to slagging other people off. Don't do this.
Yeah.
Just keep this framing here now, because it's very important people judge how you behave under pressure.
And as my granny used to say, hud your wisht. And I think that's, that you said, keep a calm, Sukh, hud your wisht. And a round of applause for you, Leslie, because I know how much you're actually suffering from the various ailments just now. And I know how important you felt it was to actually get this podcast out today, to actually give our immediate impressions on what's happened. So thanks very much to you, Leslie. And on that note, we will see you next week, chums.